This Thursday is Valentine's Day, and hearts, flowers, chocolates, cards, candy, and Cupid, the Roman god of erotic love, often comes to mind. All right, just a bit of trivia. An estimated 1 billion Valentine's Day cards are either sent or exchanged each year. Now, you think of all the ones that school children exchange, and it makes Valentine's Day the second largest card-giving holiday behind Christmas. And I read that it's school teachers. They're the ones who receive the most Valentines. The name of the day, well, it's named after one or more early Christian martyrs named Valentine. And the truth behind the various Valentine legends is really murky and ambiguous, and I'll let you Google that and sort it out yourself. But the love that this day is focused on is infatuation and erotic love. And there's certainly a place for that, as we can see from the Song of Solomon. But there's a much more important love, and that's the one that we're going to be talking about today. You see, there was once this really radical preacher who said, "If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, I become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have the gift of prophecy and know all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. And if I give all my possessions to feed the poor, and if I deliver my body to be burned," you know, speaking of martyrdom, "but do not have love, it profits me nothing." Well, that preacher, of course, was the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. And so if you haven't already, let's go ahead and turn over there. We are going to be talking about heart health, not for our physical heart, but the one where we make our decisions. This passage, you have probably heard at a wedding, or you've seen it up on someone's wall. And well, anyway, I'd like to begin by reading through the text together. Let's see what else Paul said about this thing called love. 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7. "Love is patient, love is kind, and is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things." Now, we've talked about love before. See, in English, we got one word, we use it for everything. You know, I love barbecue, and I love my wife. I love my iPhone, and I love my God. And there's obviously a big difference, at least there should be. But the ancient Greek was much more precise with its words for love. And here are the four main ones. Eros, the romantic love, and it's where we get our word erotic. That's the love that Valentine's Day is often associated with. Philia, and that's the friendship love. We've got Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, using this word. Starge, that's the family love, and this is the natural love that you have for your parents or for your children. And agape, and this is the word that we find in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. The Greeks use it in a few different ways, but in the Bible, agape is presented as the purest and the highest form of love that seeks the other's greatest good, whether they deserve it or not, the unconditional love. And this word is found almost 200 times in the New Testament in its various forms. You see, the Bible has rightly been called the most remarkable book of love in the world. And I looked at my concordance, and I only found one book in the New Testament that doesn't have the word agape, and it's Acts, which is interesting because while we don't find the word agape or agapao, the verb, in there, well, Acts, just about every page of that book, we see how our love for God and our love for man is to be demonstrated. Now, the context for our passage is chapters 12 through 14, and it's actually on spiritual gifts. It begins in chapter 12, verse 1, "Now concerning spiritual gifts," and it doesn't end until 14:40, "but let all things be done properly and in an orderly manner." I don't know how many people realize that, but this text, it comes in the midst of a discussion on the first century miraculous gifts that I believe were given as temporary support to get the church on its feet. The problem was, instead of using those gifts to build up, to strengthen, Well, the Corinthian Christians were using them to compare one to another and to look down their noses at each other, as if they're doing those things by their own power and their own authority and by their own ability. And so in the middle of that discussion, we find chapter 13. And Paul was in effect saying, you see, these miraculous gifts that you think are the end-all be-all, well, they're not going to last. There is something that is going to last, something much more important. Faith, hope, and love. The greatest being love. And at the end of chapter 12, I will show you a more excellent way. You see, their focus was in the wrong direction. Now, I think there are two very important lessons we get from our text. First, God is concerned about motives, verses 1 through 3. Now, we see that he listed some extremes here. And notice how he kept saying all mysteries, all knowledge, all faith, all my possessions. But if it doesn't come from the motivation of love, then I am a big, fat zero. See, without love, any ability we have, any knowledge we obtain, any service we render, it's not pleasing to God without love. You see, God cares not just about what we do, but why we do it. It is entirely possible to do right things with wrong motives. Now, one example is Matthew 6:1, where Jesus said, "Beware of practicing your righteousness before men to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven." Then he went on to talk about almsgiving and prayer and fasting. They're some of the most righteous things the Jewish people thought you could be engaged in. And so you can do the most righteous things for the wrong reasons. Preaching, teaching, song leading, working on the church building, hosting a family life group, visiting those in the hospital, helping with the church food pantry or clothing room, inviting the preacher over for barbecue. I mean, whatever. The Pharisees in the New Testament were a really good example of bad motives because their religious activity was often very outward and showy, just superficial. And of course, that's why Jesus called them hypocrites. See, God looks at the heart, and he always has. We see in 1 Samuel 16:7, God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And as Jesus said to the Pharisees there in Luke 16:15, "You are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts." For a Christian, the right motive, the only motive, is to be love. 1 Corinthians 16:14, "Let all that you do be done in love." So that is to be the motivation and the regulation for all that we do. We were created out of love for love. And we can place so much emphasis on being doctrinally pure and doctrinally sound that we neglect love. They're as straight as a gun barrel doctrinally, but just as cold and hard and empty. Well, a second thing that we learn from this section is that love is not a feeling. It is a doing, verses 4 through 7. And many people in our culture, they hear that word love, they think of an ooey-gooey feeling, a knot in my stomach, a quiver in my liver, or as Tina Turner would say, it's just a secondhand emotion. Who needs a heart when a heart can be broken? But no, that's not biblical agape. Agape is not a feeling, but a choice. And that's why we can be commanded to love in the Bible. And you've heard of the man going to the Christian counselor and saying, "Well, I don't love my wife anymore." And the counselor said, "Well, you don't have a choice. You're commanded to love your wife in the Bible." And he said, "Well, I can't love her as a wife." And the counselor said, "Well, you still can't get out of it because you're commanded to love your neighbor." And he said, "Well, I can't even love her as a neighbor." The counselor said, "Well, you still can't get out of it because you're commanded to love your enemies." Agape is not a feeling. And it's not just in words. 1 John 3:18, "Let us not love with word or with tongue, but in deed and truth." Anyone can say that they love you. As they say, actions speak louder than words. It's easy to talk the talk, but do you walk the walk? So here's the interesting thing. In the Greek, okay, these are all verbs in 1 Corinthians 13. You see, looking at the English, you would probably just assume that they're all adjectives. You know, love is patient, love is kind. No, it's actually more along the lines of love shows patience. Love acts with kindness. See, this is how love behaves. This is how love relates to others in the, you know, the everyday circumstances of life. And so let's take a look now at the anatomy of love, as some like to put it, in verses 4 through 7. This week, we're just going to look at the first 7 of them. So love is patient. Well, there are 2 words in the Greek for patience. One is makrothumia, which is speaking of patience with regard to other people, and hupomone, which is speaking of patience with regard to your circumstances. Now, this is interesting. This list, okay, it begins and ends with patience. It begins with this first word, and it ends with the second word. So let's talk about the first word here, makrothumia. As has been said, this is not the patience that perseveres through a long line of Disneyland. Okay, that's the other word. This is the patience that puts up with the people in the long line at Disneyland with you. You know, the ones who are bumping into you and talking too loud and smell bad and so forth. This word, it literally means long temper. And sometimes you find it translated as long suffering. You see, you suffer long before you react. And simply put, it's having tolerance, putting up with people. We can and do rub each other the wrong way at times. I mean, I'm going to irritate you. You're going to irritate me. And the natural reaction is anger and resentment and bitter words. I don't know, maybe even blows. But someone with this quality, when they're wronged, well, they have the power to avenge, but they don't. And patience is not a sign of defeat, as some people might think. It's rather a sign of victory and strength, because anyone can be short, you know, get upset and be short with someone. Patience, though, it takes a lot of self-control. I think Abraham Lincoln was a good example of this. Now, from what I've read, no one treated him worse or with more contempt than Edwin Stanton. And among other things, he called Lincoln a low, cunning clown and the original gorilla. But Lincoln always treated him, he treated Stanton with just every respect. He even made Stanton his war secretary. Well, after Lincoln was assassinated, Stanton is credited with saying, "There lies the greatest ruler of men the world has ever seen. The power of patience." You see, sometimes I'm a pain. Sometimes I'm slow. Give me time. Ephesians 4, 1 and 2. "I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, entreat you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, showing forbearance to one another in love." All right, next, love is kind. This word has to do with sweetness and tenderness. It's a conscious effort not to hurt. It's showing sympathy and consideration and understanding. And as it's been said, kindness is a language the deaf can hear and the blind can see. See, this is how Jesus treated the sinful woman at the Pharisee's house in Luke chapter 7. This is how Jesus treated the woman caught in adultery in John chapter 8. And kindness is pretty obvious, isn't it? Some people give pain and others ease pain. You know, some people are like porcupines, and others are like teddy bears. Some people, they just seem to delight in being blunt and brutal. But harsh words and actions, they can cut someone really deeply, and they can severely damage a sensitive person. And so we need to do our best to be kind, and also not to miss any opportunities to do kindness. As it's been said, why do we often wait till someone dies before we send them flowers? I like what the philosopher and poet Ralph Waldo Emerson said. "You cannot do a kindness too soon, because you never know how soon it will be too late." I've heard of suicide notes that said they were going to give it one more day. And if just one person acknowledged them and showed them some kindness, they wouldn't have killed themselves. Be kind to me. There are times when I need it. Ephesians 4, 31 and 32, it says, "Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. and be kind to one another. Love is not jealous. He may be a better preacher than I am, a better teacher, a better song leader, a better personal evangelist, a better handyman, etc. She may be a better children's teacher, a better cook, a better decorator, a better entertainer, a better organizer, etc. You see, love, it's not jealous of the honor or the abilities or the success of others. Romans 12:15, it says, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. We often find it easier to weep with those who weep. Love never detracts from the praise that is due another. Love, it lets other people shine. It lets them have the limelight. They can have the glory and the spotlight for the moment. Love never puts them down because of jealousy or wishes that they didn't have it. Rejoice with those who rejoice. You look at the first two brothers. Cain killed Abel because of jealousy. That's not a pretty picture. Maybe this person has exactly what you want. Okay, this is what you have been, that's what you've been working towards, what you've been praying for, and every time you look at them, then, you know, these jealous feelings just well up in you. Well, guess what? There are things that person wants as well that they don't have. And you've probably seen this on Facebook. People, it's been going around, where there's a guy in an old car, and he looks over and says, look at that new car. But then there's a guy on a bike, and he says, if only I could afford a car. And then there's a guy on foot, and he says, I wish I had a bike. And then there's a guy in a wheelchair looking, and he can go wherever he wants. Well, I think there are two ways to help get rid of jealousy. One is to fill your heart with gratitude and appreciation for what God has given you. I was at a lectureship where Willard Tate, he was talking about a college class that he taught really early in the morning. And the students came in, and he said, all right, I want you all to get out a piece of paper and write down 12 good things that happened today. And all they started complaining. You know, what do you mean 12 good? I've only been awake for 30 minutes. And he said, all right, fine. You woke up this morning and you were alive. Is that a good thing? Write that down. Okay, and you opened your eyes and you could see. Is that a good thing? And you got out of bed and you could walk. And you didn't have to go down to the river. You turned a tap and you had instant hot water. And you see, it really, it's not that hard to find 12 good things even in the first 30 minutes of your day. And so we need to get the gratitude attitude. As that song tells us, count your blessings. Name them one by one. And I like the saying, never allow what you don't have keep you from being thankful for what you do have. And two, stop comparing yourself to others. As I don't care what you do, there will always be those who are bigger, better, faster, stronger, smarter, prettier, more money, possessions, power, or prestige. I think that's everything. Be grateful for what you do have. And stop comparing yourself to others. So I think that'll help to keep us from becoming jealous. Be yourself and allow me to be me. Don't let someone intimidate you into thinking that you need to be them. James 3:16. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing. Next, love does not brag. See, this is trying to make other people jealous of you. Love doesn't parade itself. Love, it doesn't brag about its possessions, accomplishments, or abilities. Love tries to lift others up, not yourself. How do you feel about a braggart? They're always the subject. Look at me, ain't I wonderful? No matter what story they're telling, it always, you know, it always has to do with them being the hero. And this usually comes from, well, one of three areas. Either arrogance, you know, they truly think that they are better than others. You know, being starved for attention as a child, and so it becomes a habit. or from a feeling of inadequacy and insecurity. See, they're actually intimidated, and so it's a facade. But you notice that none of these three are admirable. Francis Bacon, the 16th century philosopher and scientist, made a very interesting statement. And it was something to the effect that a bragging man is scorned by the wise and admired by fools. Don't toot your own horn. And here's a good exercise. Do something good and keep it a secret. Can you do that? Don't brag at me. Trust me to love you for who you are. In the list of qualities and things being done by those with a depraved mind, well, Romans 1:30 mentions boastful. Proverbs 27:2, let another praise you and not your own mouth. A stranger, not your own lips. See, let your virtues speak for themselves. Love is not arrogant. Now, this word literally means puffed up in the Greek. This is an overestimation of one's importance, having an inflated ego. And it usually causes people to look down their noses at others, having a holier-than-thou, better-than-thou attitude and disposition. Napoleon, he's credited at one point of saying, I am not a man like other men. The laws of convention and morality do not apply to me. It's amazing. As it's been said, a man dressed in a little brief authority can be a sorry sight. I heard about a survey in the past, and it was of teenagers, and it was asking them, if they could change one thing about their dad, what would it be? And the number two answer was, I wish he would admit when he is wrong. Love is not arrogant. I want to share with you again that poem by Saxon White Kessinger. Sometime when you're feeling important, sometime when your ego's in bloom, sometime when you take it for granted you're the best qualified in the room, sometime when you feel that your going would leave an unfillable hole, just follow these simple instructions and see how they humble your soul. Take a bucket and fill it with water. Put in your hand up to the wrist. Pull it out, and the hole that's remaining is a measure of how much you'll be missed. You can splash all you wish when you enter. You may stir up the water galore. But stop, and you'll find that in no time, it looks quite the same as before. The moral of this quaint example is do just the best that you can. Be proud of yourself, but remember, there's no indispensable man. Winston Churchill, he was asked one time if it made him feel good that every time he spoke, well, the halls were just full and overflowing. And he replied, it's quite flattering, but whenever I feel that way, I always remember that if instead of making a political speech, I was being hanged, the crowd would be twice as big. There's never a place for arrogance in Christianity. Just remember the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector in Luke chapter 18. The only one of them left there justified before God. And it wasn't the one that you'd normally think. So I don't care who you are still a sinner. Because the thing is, we're not pretty good and we're not pretty clean. Before God, our righteous deeds don't amount to a pile of dirty rags. You know, if God doesn't allow the blood of Jesus to cover me, I am going to spend eternity where I deserve to go, where we all deserve to go. And that's not with him. Romans chapter 12 and verse 3. For the grace given to me, I say to every man among you not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think. And Romans 12:16, be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind, but associate with the lowly. Do not be wise in your own estimation. You see, it's only by the grace of God that we're anything. Keep Haman in mind. You know, the bad guy from the book of Esther had a real problem with arrogance and with pride. And well, he ended up being hanged on the very gallows that he had made for Mordecai. Proverbs 16:18, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. Love does not act unbecomingly or rude, as the NIV says. And so this is speaking of acting in such a way that it's proper and respectful without rudeness. It's been said, rudeness is the weak man's imitation of strength. See, some people, you'd have to say they act like animals, you know, just unseemly conduct and tactlessness and without respect. They're just jerks, insensitive and offensive. See, some people speak to others and, well, even to their own children and their family members worse than you would to an animal. See, never forget that the courtesy and tact and politeness, you know, those are admirable things. A little courtesy goes a long way. Laugh with people, not at people. Now, I think a good example of this is to look at Jesus and how he dealt with interruptions. For example, in Mark chapter 5, because you remember, well, he goes to the country of the Gerasenes, and as soon as he gets out, he's interrupted with this man with demons, and he's got to deal with that. But then the people, they tell him that, well, they don't want him here, and he get out of here, and so he's got to get back in the boat, and he goes to the other side. Well, gets to the other side of the lake. Well, all these people, they're coming, and they all want things, and then this man Jairus comes, and of course, he wants Jesus to come and heal his daughter. Well, while he's going off with Jairus, this woman who's got a hemorrhage, she touches him, and now he's interrupted from his interruptions, and it just keeps going and going. But you notice that he's always so thoughtful. He's always thoughtful of others and their feelings. And yes, there are some times when Jesus used strong words, and he had to tell it as it is, but he was never rude to people. He never acted unbecomingly. Don't be a jerk. All people, no matter who they are, they should be treated with manners and respect, even if they don't deserve it. Why? Well, because that's what love does. Matthew 7:12, therefore, however you want people to treat you, so treat them. Who likes being treated rudely? Love does not seek its own. Of course, this is speaking of selfishness and self-seeking. Just looking out for number one. We all struggle with that little voice in our heads that just keeps pounding, me, me, me. And for some people, I'm sure you've discovered this, even their benevolence, it's not true altruism. Because there's always an angle, what they can get out of it. But if you love me, you won't try to use and manipulate me. You see, love gives up rights. Love is forgetful of self and thoughtful of others. Richard Lenski, he made the comment, selfishness lies at the root of 1,000 evils and sins in the world and in the church. Between rich and poor, capital and labor, nation and nation, man and man, church member and church member. Cure selfishness and you plant a Garden of Eden. And I like how William Barclay put it. There are, in this world, only two kinds of people, those who always insist upon their privileges and those who always remember their responsibilities. Those who are always thinking of what life owes them and those who never forget what they owe to life. It would be the key to almost all the problems which surround us today if men would think less of their rights and more of their duties. I think of Jesus while on the cross. If there was ever a time that a person should be allowed to be selfish and be thinking of themselves, that would be it. And yet, what did he do? He took the time to ask God to forgive those who were crucifying him, to save the sinner on the cross next to him, and then to make sure his mother would be taken care of in her old age. It's just amazing to me. Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 through 4. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Okay, next week, we are going to continue with the next seven, the last seven here. This list is what God wants from us. This is what he designed us to be. We're made in his image. And Paul tells us to be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love. Ephesians 5, 1 and 2. John tells us, the one who does not love does not know God, for God is love. 1 John 4, 8. Looking at 1 Corinthians 13. Okay, I realized that I got a long way to go. Now put your name in there. Ty is patient and kind. Well, to most people, unless he's had a really bad day. Ty is not jealous, unless he sees something really cool. Ty does not brag and is not arrogant, unless he's done a really exceptional job, and so forth. As I've said before, I preach about perfection, but I don't live perfection. Preachers struggle with trying to be like Jesus, the same as everyone else. And see, we see these qualities and actions realized in Jesus. His is the only name that can truly be inserted here, be substituted for love in this passage. You might say that when Paul, you know, when Paul was painting this portrait of love, Jesus, he was the one sitting for the portrait. That's why I think we need to spend a lot of time in the Gospels. Jesus said, it is enough for the student to be like his teacher, for the servant to be like his master. That's our goal. Never be satisfied with where you're at. Paul, he wrote to the church at Thessalonica, he said, now as to the love of the brethren, you have no need for anyone to write to you, for you yourselves are taught by God to love one another. For indeed you do practice it toward all the brethren who are in Macedonia. But we urge you, brethren, to excel still more. There's always room for growth and improvement. Love. Love is what Christianity is all about. The love of God for man, the love of man for God, and the love of man for man. Let all that you do be done in love.